want to really go through a bit of a review before we get into some new stuff, only because, one, we didn't tape it, so that at least if we have the review on tape, people can fill in the gaps. But what we started to look at is new numbering in the instructing section of the last part of the Book of Numbers. And we looked in chapter 26 and 27 where the numbering begins to take place. And what we saw is basically under the old census that they took, they had approximately 600,000 people. And in the new census, approximately 600,000 people. And it kind of fit in with the theme of the whole book. You know, a whole lot of activity to accomplish nothing. And it's really
mostly do.
I feel that way sometimes in my life too. That's a different story. But yeah, it is. So they spent roughly 40 years accomplishing nothing and being where they were at the beginning of the 40 years. So we looked at that. Then the next thing we looked at the end of chapter 27 is Zelophehad. I don't know why I can't spit that name out.
I wonder why.
I have a hard enough time with English, let alone.
Just call Mr. Z.
Yeah, Mr. Z. But we looked at it, the inheritance laws that are being addressed there. And the idea that a lady or a woman could inherit her tribe's inheritance, if her father's inheritance, if she marries another man from the same tribe. And this becomes critical because this is why we have two different birth accounts in the Gospels. Matthew goes through the account of one, and Luke goes through the account of the other, and what you have is this law that's being applied because the inheritance was taken away from Joseph's end of the equation, especially in the book of Jeremiah when Jeremiah pronounces a curse and says that they were cut off and they would not see an inheritance. So the Davidic line comes through Mary, and the inheritance comes through that idea. And that's part of the reason why the virgin birth is such an important doctrine. Then we got into the new instructing. In chapter 28 and 29, we saw the laws dealing with the offerings. And we saw, in particular in chapter 28, there were the daily offerings, the Sabbath offerings, the new month offerings, and offerings dealing with the festivals or the feasts. And then from there, chapter 30 went into the concerns about vows. And we saw it addressed vows that men make, vows that maidens make or unmarried women, vows of women being betrothed, vows of widows, and vows of wives, and each one accomplishing a certain goal and aspect. And then we spent a lot of time going through the retribution against Midian in chapter 31. And we saw that God had a case against the Midianites, and he executed his case against them by having them wiped out. And from our perspective in the 21st century, it was pretty brutal and vicious. But from God's perspective, it was the only way to root out certain evil. It looks like we dropped Redmond here. Let me retry calling him. Sometimes you drop a call.
That could be the weather.
But we'll see if he connects. But
do you guys think you lost me?
Yeah, I thought we did.
Yeah, I thought I
thought I did too. I hit the wrong button over here, sorry.
Oh, that's okay. No problem. So you have the case against the Midianites and how that case is executed against them in chapter 32, or I'm sorry, 31. I want to look at 32 in some detail tonight. This is new information. And this is important. Coming on the heels of the victory over the Midianites, there's a request that on the surface of it looks to be a reasonable request. Chapter 32 and verse 1, if somebody'd like to read that.
Now the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of cattle. And when they saw that the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that, behold, the place was a place for cattle.
Okay, now this is interesting because you have here Reuben and Gad, where they're looking at the land that they've just conquered from the Midianites. And they have all kinds of cattle and are saying this land would be perfect for our cattle to graze. So they're going to make a request in verse 2. The children of Gad and the children of Reuben came and spake unto Moses and to Eleazar the priest, and unto the princes of the congregation, saying. Now, coming down in verse 4, even the country which the Lord smote before the congregation of Israel is a land for cattle, and thy servants have cattle. Wherefore, said they, if we have found grace in thy sight, let this land be given unto thy servants for possession, and bring us not over Jordan. Now, it's interesting because you have a request. Yes, the promised land is when we cross over the Jordan in the land that's on the other side. But there's some land here that would really sustain our cattle. And on the surface of it, it seems reasonable. They have lots of cattle. And you've got to take care of that cattle. There's a number of problems here, though, and they're falling into the same trap that somebody else had fallen into. Okay, they didn't learn a lesson from their forefathers. And if you go back into Genesis, let's go back into Genesis. I want to look at chapter 15. Yep. By sight. If you go back into Numbers 32, Let's look at verse 1 again. Now the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of cattle. And when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that, behold, the place was a place for cattle. Again, like Lot, they see something. Now the interesting thing here is that they're choosing by their sight. It's not a faith-based decision. It's a sight-based decision that Reuben and Gad are making, and later on Manasseh will be added into it because there's a half-tribe of Manasseh. Half of Manasseh will stay and the other half will go. The problem is that they're looking at it and they're looking at something that's expedient and beneficial for them and has the appeal to them, and they've ignored what God has already promised.
I mean, don't they think that it could be over there as well as where they were?
Well, that's the whole point. Right. In fact, the thing is, they're not looking to go into the land that God had promised them and God had said that he would give to them. They're looking to stay where they are. And it's interesting because this decision will ultimately be the ruin of these tribes. It just not right away. It takes its time to play out. This area becomes the Transjordan area, by the way, if you ever hear anybody make a reference to the Transjordan area of Israel. Now, it's interesting because in this, look down at verse, we read verse 6, verse 5, let's read verse 6. And Moses said unto the children of Gad, to the children of Reuben, shall your brethren go to war, and shall ye sit here? And wherefore discourage ye the heart of the children of Israel from going over into the land, now notice what he says, which Yahweh has given them. Thus did your fathers when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up unto the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the heart of the children of Israel that they should not go into the land which Yahweh had given them. I want to stop there. Moses says, this is the same trap that led to our 40-year pasturing in this land. And by making this decision, you are going to discourage your brothers from going into the land that Yahweh has given them. Now, it's interesting. Moses is speaking already in the positive. He has given it to them. Not that he shall give to them. It's already given to them. Right? In verse 10, Yahweh's anger was kindled at the same time. Now, I think it's interesting. It's Moses talking. He's recounting how Yahweh's anger was burning against 10 of the spies, and 2 of the spies, Caleb and Joshua, were given special benefits, so to speak.
Doesn't necessarily mean he's mad at the children of
Reuben or Gad. No, he's recounting. But the whole point that Moses is getting at here is that what is this going to do for the defense? Now, for the sake of reading, I'm not going to read all of it. For the sake of reading, though, they agree that they would come and they would help take the land. And to their credit, they do that. Right? But the problem becomes that down the road, those promises fall by the wayside. They always do. You know, it's not convenient for me to cross that river to go and fight. I'll sit here on the sideline. And there's something that occurs, son. There's a net result to all of this. If you go to 1 Chronicles, chapter 5, and in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, I want to read down through verse, starting at verse 18, down through verse 26. So 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verses 18 through 26. This is the end result, looking out into the future. Maybe we could read around the room. But 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 18, going through to the end of the chapter. I'll read verse 18. The sons of Reuben and the Gadites and half the tribe of Manasseh, of valiant men, able to bear buckler and sword and to shoot with bow and skillful in war, were 440,703 that went out to the war.
In 1 Chronicles 5.
1 Chronicles 5, verse 18. I just read.
Oh, verse 18.
Yep.
410 or 20?
20. 20.
What is a buckler?
A buckler is like a shield.
And they made war with the Hagarines, Hagarites, and with Jeter. Why does it say that people of the land whom God destroyed before them.
Right.
How could they go whoring after something that God had destroyed?
Well, the whole point was, and the key is further up in the passage, in verse 21. They took away their cattle, of their camels, 50,000, of sheep, 250,000, and of asses, 2,000, and of men, 100,000. So you took 100,000 warriors captive. We have to assume that's a lot of people.
Not a lot.
That's, you have to also assume they took the women and the children. And what happened is they began to learn about the gods of these people who they conquered.
What a good time they used to have, the groves and
all this
practices.
You know, their gods were so great that God destroyed them. There's an appeal. A lot of these religions, by the way, in this area that we looked at in some detail, I think it was last week, might have been the week before, but we saw some of the appeal that they had was of a sexual nature.
Right.
And there were a lot of sex rites, and it created carnality. And I think that's the interesting phraseology when he says they went to whoring.
Mm-hmm.
It implies that idea. And the idea is that we are becoming like the Canaanite people that we were to conquer and move on from. We were to cross that Jordan. We were to... It's almost like a Christian... when they first get saved, right? They have a choice to make. The choice any believer has is, I'm really going to live the life that God wants me to live, that I understand I need, because that's why I got saved. Or, the appeal is to stay where you are, be content with the same people that you've always been with, not make any changes, and see where that takes you. What ends up typically happening? Well, those people that stay in all the activities they were in before salvation typically end up being the same as they were before salvation. They're very carnal Christians. They don't advance in their Christian walk. They're frozen in place, and you wouldn't even know them to be believers because they haven't progressed. But this is the result, then, of that appeal to the eyes. It's the same thing that happened to Lot, by the way.
Yeah.
You know?
So, could you say that the term go a-whoring after has to deal mostly with chasing other gods?
It does. They enjoined themselves to other gods.
But with a little libidinous twist.
Yeah.
It's not like today, where you're enamored of a doctrine of, say, predestination or fatalism or something with Calvinism. Their doctrines there, I believe, they're all part and parcel with hedonism.
Yeah.
Right.
Sensuality.
All those things. And I think the sad thing,
the worship of the flesh,
right? The flesh, the pull of the flesh becomes too great for them to resist until they're back living like they were still in the flesh. And the same thing happened a lot. Remember the sad end result, right? God's come. He's warning him. This place is about to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And Lot wants to stay. And he's arguing to stay. I mean, he's trying to justify, well, you know, what if I give them my daughters? Now, can you imagine a father being...
repulsive.
It is. And then the end result is, he thinks the whole world has been destroyed. He's living in this cave, and he ends up having a sexual relationship with both of his daughters, producing two of the most evil groups of people that have ever existed.
That we're reading about now.
Yeah, we are. which is pathetic. But that's where it took him. And that failure for these tribes to advance is what becomes their downfall. Now, it's interesting because we read in verse 26 of the rise of Assyria and these 2.5 tribes going into Assyrian captivity. The writer of Chronicles covers it in one verse, right? He says, "And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Paul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tilgath-Pilneser, king of Assyria. And he carried them away, even the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them unto Hala," that's a city, these are all Assyrian cities, "Hala and Habor and Hara, and to the river Gozan unto this day." So they're still in captivity at the time of the writing of the Book of Chronicles.
There were three tribes.
Yeah, 2.5 tribes.
Yeah, right.
Yep. Because like I said, I spare us the reading by not going through where Manasseh joins Lot with them. But he does, the half tribe does. So what you have here is this is the end result. Let me go to another passage here in 1 Kings chapter 15. 1 Kings chapter 15. In verse 29. Okay, actually, just so we get the flow of what happened here, let's start at verse 27, just so we get a flow. If somebody'd like to read 27 down through 29.
Baasha, the son of Ahijah, of the house of Issachar, conspired against him, and Baasha smote him at Gibeathon, which belongs to the Philistines, for Nadab and all Israel laid siege to Gibeathon. Even in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, did Baasha slay him, and reigned in his stead. And it came to pass, when he reigned, that he smote all the house of Jeroboam. He left not to Jeroboam any that breathed, until he had destroyed them, according unto the saying of the Lord, which is spake by his servants, Ahijah the Shilonite.
So here we have the discord that begins to come into this area. Now, two and a half of the main tribes, is this Transjordan area for Israel, the 10 northern tribes. And what we have here is a rebellion. Now, this is an interesting chapter because you have Baasha becomes king. He's from Issachar, right? So according to all that God has said and done, Issachar has no claim to the throne. Yet, here's this guy making a claim. And what you have here is this civil war just begins to ensue, and violence, and all of these things. And all you read is they did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. And the whole point here is you end up with a divided kingdom. You end up with a divided kingdom that one sometimes is good, the other one is never good, and falls into ruin. And really, it implements a policy of religion that combines the Canaanite religions with Yahwehism. You have a combination, kind of hybrid religion. Go to another passage in 2 Kings 15. Here about what we read in Chronicles. Okay, so 2 Kings 15, if somebody would like to read 29 there, verse 29.
"And Jeroboam slept with his fathers." It says 14.
Yep.
Sorry.
That's okay.
"In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, came to Tiglath-Pileser,
now made captive. And the whole point of that is, again, they're made captive because the tribes that should have been there to protect him, the Ephtali, aren't there because they're back on the other side of the river, or the Jordan River. And
Naphtali went over there?
No, I'm saying the Naphtali was...
Oh, they were subjected because their flank was taken away.
That's correct.
You know, what were those verses that we just read?
The one...
This one was 2 Kings...
What you just read?
2 Kings 15,
29.
That was important.
Yeah. So the whole point that you have here is this Transjordan...
Just one second.
Okay.
I was quite sure that when we read this Tiglath-Pileser, it was Tilgath-Pileser. So it must be
different guy.
Different guy. Yeah. This is Tiglath. That was Tilgath. I thought this was something
strange. They're two different guys. And what you have here is this idea of Assyria just... It's like Assyria just is coming in now. It takes away the flank, carries it into captivity, and now you've opened up a giant breach into the defense, into the kingdom of Israel itself. And now he can just pick it off at leisure, which they do. And they come in, and I mean, the whole thing becomes a real sad commentary of Israel's history. Look at chapter 16 for a second. Okay. Chapter 16, verses 3 and 4.
But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, yea, and made his son to pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the heathen, whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel. And he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places and on the hills and under every green tree.
Now remember, last week we looked at one of the things that God was judging the Midianites for, was the fact not the Midianites, but the Canaanites. One of the things that they were being judged for was the child sacrifice and burning the children. Yet we read Israel doing the exact same thing here. Right? They cast out from the... They walked in the way of the kings of Israel. They made their sons to pass through the fire. In other words, to pass through the fire is they basically put the child onto an altar and burnt the child alive. They roasted them. It literally, in today's vernacular, we would say they roasted the child. And it's horrific, right? And what you have recorded here is they sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places and on the hills and so on. The high place.
Maybe to cover up the smell of burning flesh.
Well, that's part of the reason for the incense, but the idea of building the on the high places and on the hills, a lot of times that phrase high places is translated as an Asherah pole. It's literally it's a god, one of the Canaanite gods, goddess actually. And it was a like a totem pole sort of a structure. And what they would often typically do is all kinds of bizarre religious sex rites at the pole. And while they're doing it, they're burning a child that's passing through the fire. They're roasting their children.
They must have had a lot of babies.
Right into that. Yeah. It's a straight shot in. Yeah.
Half shot, to the other half.
when you look at it on a map, it's so obvious on how easy it was for Assyria to come in. So when you look at that, when you look at this whole thing, it's just the sad state of where this request goes. It's like with Lot, right? Lot didn't change the inhabitants of the land. The inhabitants of the land changed him and his family, right? Now Lot, in fairness, Lot is referred to as being just or righteous.
Yeah.
And it is said that he was vexed or tormented.
And he sat in the gate. No doubt he had some influence, but not enough to do anything.
Not enough to do anything. So that takes me to, if you want to go to Book of Mark for a second. The Book of Mark, chapter 5. Verse 17. is the result of the citizens, verse 16. And those who had been eyewitnesses told them what had happened to the one who had been demon-possessed and to the swine. And they began to beg him, speaking of Jesus, to depart from their borders. As he was embarking, the man who had been possessed with the demon asked permission to accompany him. Now it's interesting, the demon-possessed man is liberated, he wants to go with Jesus, but the people as a whole see all of this, and rather than being grateful that Jesus accomplished something magnificent, what is it that they want? Get Jesus out of here.
They're happy to get rid of him.
We don't want him here.
It cost them 2,000 pigs.
It did. Now this is the end result of where the Transjordan area goes. Okay? They end up being so enmeshed with the gods of the Canaanites that they've adopted their customs. Not only have they adopted their customs, but demons overwhelm the entire region. That's where they are. Right? And that's the sad state of affairs of where that takes them. Now, the rest of the book of Numbers is pretty simple, and I'm not going to really elaborate on it in a lot. But chapter 33, you're going to have a summary of Israel's journeyings from Egypt to the Jordan. Okay, they're going to go back and recount how they had left Egypt with Moses and got to this point where they are. In chapter 34 of Numbers, you're going to have the boundaries of the land of all the tribes given. Chapter 35, and we talked about this in some detail in a past study, is the cities of refuge. And it lays out the different cities of refuge. And then chapter 36 ends with the security of inheritance for Israel in the land. And that's really how the book of Numbers plays out. So, you know, I think chapter here, 32, becomes significant in the sense that it's Israel not fully wanting to take what God had promised them. A part of Israel wants to stay in that land. They want to stay enmeshed in those behaviors, in the culture. There's an appeal to them with it. There's an appeal to the point of where they were willing. Think about this. You have, back when they're in Egypt, right? Israel could have left Egypt after the famine that brought them there in the first place. But they didn't. They stayed there, and then they became enslaved, and then they had to cry out for God to help them.
They had a good start.
They did the start, but they couldn't help them. And it wasn't what God had promised them. That's the whole point, though. And they were content. They were content with being there, and it created nothing but heartache for them. And the same thing becomes true in Numbers 31, or 32, I'm sorry. They are content because it looks good. They're walking by sight, and they're devoid of the idea of faith. Yes, God promised the land, but this looks so much better. And that's where they stay. And it becomes the downfall of the nation. It really does.
That's almost like parallel what has been in this nation for the past several decades, is to integrate all these different cultures. To find out, well, how do you do this? Oh, that looks interesting.
It was interesting. I saw a commercial on TV the other day. I think it was yesterday. It was a commercial on for one of the clothing stores. And they were selling T-shirts for National Pride Day. have, I'm not exaggerating, they had these little kids in these pride t-shirts that was like rainbow. One of them kind of gives a different spin on it, but one of them said something to the effect of love wins. Another one is of acceptance, you know, and it's all in the rainbow sort of thing. I can't remember.
I didn't see that commercial.
I can't remember what clothing store it was. But
the Bellows has them in their, with their American flag ones.
Yeah, these are for the pride.
Gay pride.
Yeah, because June's coming up.
And June?
June is where they have the gay pride parade.
I had to change part of my clown costume because it was full of rainbow colors.
Yeah, that's sad. But what's happened is these are behaviors that are contrary to God that begin to be embraced in a society. And as they begin to be embraced in a society, the society starts that downward spiral until it hits that point of no return. And the beginning point of it for Israel was before they were ever even in the land. They had 2.5 tribes make a decision. We're going to stay here. And it led to the ruin, ultimately. And it infested, the thinking infests even into Judah eventually. Because later on when you read of Judah, and you read of, my mind just went blank, Manasseh. Manasseh has, in the temple, right, he has next to the altar, he has images of some of the Canaanite gods that are next to the altar of God so that they could sacrifice to Yahweh and to those other gods. Right in the temple. And I mean, it's crazy when you look at it, but that just shows you how this thinking, the willingness to stay rooted where you are, and that's the problem with a lot of Christians.